Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Economists talk a lot about supply and demand, how they go hand in hand to make the markets work. But there is something else that doesn't always get a fair shake, a little thing called price. Food prices, gas prices, oil prices, yeah, we got it all today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 23rd of April, and oil traders played a little trick on us today. The futures contracts that are being worked on the floor of the New York Mercantile Exchange flipped from May to June this morning. So if you happen to notice that crude was a hair lower, down under $117 a barrel early on, don't pay it no mind. Happens every time the contract turns over. But it's gas I really wanted to get you thinking about. Nationwide, the average is now $3.53 a gallon. Not much doubt it's going to hit $4 soon enough. But consider this. The Energy Department says compared to a year ago, gasoline demand is actually lower now. Economists would call that a classic example of price elasticity. From New York, Ashley Miltite reports it could be called something else, too.
Rather than call it a tipping point, you could look at this as a long, slow slide. It may have started last year. Troy Green is a spokesman for the American Automobile Association. He says the AAA's Michigan Club has surveyed members about last summer's then-record gas prices.
Three out of four of those surveyed said that they consolidated their shopping trips when possible. You had three out of 10 that said that they changed over and began driving a more fuel-efficient vehicle.
He says we'll know more when AAA reports next month on summer driving plans. Speaking of summer, Peter Yesowicz of marketing firm The Y Partnership says high gas prices won't cause many people to cancel vacations, but he expects them to adjust their plans.
That means, again, typically staying a little closer to home, driving a shorter distance, spending a little less on other aspects of the trip beyond transportation.
But what about just getting around? The American Public Transportation Association says people are riding more buses and trains. Morgan Lyons is a spokesman for Dallas Area Rapid Transit. He says at times like this, Dallas drivers start hitting up the DART website to find out how to take a train to work.
We've seen nice growth in web traffic about the time we see spikes in gasoline, and that is a precursor to a spike in ridership.
This February, he says ridership jumped 14% over last year. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Okay, that's consumers, but what if you had to use gas? Trucking businesses are a good example. They're being hurt by the high price of diesel. But airlines are an even better one. Delta and Northwest reported today between them they lost $10.5 billion during the first 3 months of the year. Jet fuel was a big chunk of that. Last week, the two companies announced a merger in part to try to get some economies of scale on things like fuel. The deal would create the world's largest airline. But first, they have to convince antitrust officials in Washington the merger won't harm consumers. To that end, the company's CEOs testify before two congressional committees tomorrow, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Delta and Northwest's financial miseries have plenty of company. United, American, and Continental also lost money in the first quarter. The industry only recently recovered from a wave of bankruptcies, and once again, airlines are laying off workers, grounding planes, and adding fuel surcharges and extra baggage fees. Delta and Northwest claim size will help them cope better with the economic pressures facing the entire industry. They'll be able to reduce management costs, consolidate routes, and trim overlapping inventories. Congress and the Justice Department might worry that consumer choice will suffer, but airline management expert Daryl Jenkins says the industry's financial headwinds will influence antitrust considerations.
There is a provision in antitrust law for failing industries. I don't know if the airline industry is covered under that yet, but certainly I think regulators will look at this.
What's more, Jenkins says, the merging airlines can point to vigorous competition from many low-cost airlines these days, something United and U.S. Airways couldn't argue when their merger failed some years ago. If Delta and Northwest get the go-ahead, Jenkins expects more airline mergers before the year is out. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The miracle of modern medicine means that in some cases you can know more about your health than maybe you'd want to. You can take tests and find out whether you're predisposed to certain kinds of cancer or Alzheimer's or heart disease. Then your doctor plans your treatment around those results. But some people have been reluctant to take those tests out of fear that they could lose their health insurance or even their jobs. Tomorrow, the Senate's expected to take up a bill that'll outlaw what's come to be called genetic discrimination. It could also give a big boost to the businesses of genetic testing and personalized medicine. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Here's one view of the future of DNA mapping from the movie Gattaca.
Manic depression, 42% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Life expectancy, 30.2 years.
And DNA like that could cost you your job or your health insurance in some states. Linda Avey is co-founder of 23andMe, a company that maps people's DNA. She says a federal law could make a big difference in her industry.
We do feel like this, at a federal level, is going to hopefully make people more comfortable with the idea of getting access to their DNA.
Edward Abrahams heads up the Personalized Medicine Coalition. He says research that could help patients with a genetic disposition for cancer, for instance, has been hamstrung. That's because clinical trial patients who may already have the disease often drop out when they learn their genetic information can't be protected.
There are, in my view, too few products on the market. And that is because we have had obstacles like fear of genetic discrimination.
But that's not the only thing limiting the growth of the DNA mapping market, says biotech venture capitalist Doug Fambro. He says another big obstacle is that genetic research requires a lot of time, and marketable discoveries are probably years away.
Most of the work that's really going to drive personalized medicine will emerge from the publicly funded genome centers. So I think it will emerge fairly slowly, actually, over the next decade or so.
The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which has been in the works for more than a decade, is expected to pass into law quickly. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Modest gains are what this Wednesday brought to Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's a news item you might not expect to hear on an American radio broadcast. Walmart has decided to ration rice. Today, the retailer's warehouse division, Sam's Club, announced it's limiting certain kinds of rice to 4 bags per customer. The CEO of Costco said basically the same thing yesterday. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk on rising food prices and consumer habits.
Sam's Club released a short statement today saying they were limiting sales of jasmine, basmati, and long-grain white rices. Rival Costco says some of its stores have also restricted purchases of rice and flour. Both warehouse chains report heavy demand for the food staples recently. Tim Johnson, president of the California Rice Commission, suspects many of the chain's small business buyers, like restaurants and grocers, are stocking up.
Faced with the price increases that we've had in the last year, where prices have almost doubled, folks are making a decision now to purchase in anticipation that prices will go up more.
Prices took a big jump recently after India and Vietnam announced they would curb rice exports in order to stabilize prices at home. Thailand may soon join them. USDA economist Ephraim Liebtag.
For the average consumer, again, it's just a question of what substitutes are available. Although currently a lot of food products are going up at the same time, so it seems like there are going to be higher prices here across the board.
Basmati and jasmine rice are largely imported, but U.S. growers say there's no shortage of domestically grown long grain rice. Costco's CEO said yesterday his store was moving to ease limits. Quote, "We don't want to create a panic situation." I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Obviously, it's prices that are contributing to those food shortages, whether the scarcity's real or perceived. Rice hit another record today. It's up 146% over the past 12 months. Expensive for Americans, downright dangerous for many of the world's poorest consumers. Per Pinstrup Andersen is a professor of food and public policy at Cornell University. Professor, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
That piece we just heard about retailers worried about hoarding here in the United States, how does that strike you, that news?
I don't really think retail stores should get in the business of providing quotas of food for people. Let the market work.
On a wider sense, this global food crisis that we are having here, first of all, is crisis the right word?
Yes, it is. For people who cannot afford to buy the food they need to feed their kids, we have a real crisis, and it is worse than it was before.
Historically, how much worse? Where does this rank?
This is probably about as bad as it has ever been. About 34 years ago, we had another food crisis where prices were extremely high. But prices have dropped so much during these 30 or so years up until 5 years ago. And, of course, wages were lower because of that. So now with this abrupt increase in food prices, a lot of people are caught in a squeeze. They simply cannot afford to buy enough food.
People who can't afford to eat obviously become very unhappy very quickly. We've seen riots in Haiti. We've seen breadline riots in Egypt. How equipped are the governments of some of these countries to deal with food riots and social unrest?
Well, the governments have been very complacent with respect to investment in rural infrastructure, such as roads and markets and institutions and so on. And that's one of the reasons why many of the poor people in developing countries, even though they are in agriculture, they are net buyers of food. They simply cannot produce what they need. Could the governments turn this around now? Yes, I think they have to. It's going to take time. And in the meantime, we from outside of the developing countries have to provide the necessary emergency food aid to such organizations as the World Food Program so that we can help the people who are currently starving. But at the same time, we have to help developing countries get their priorities right in the longer term by investing in rural infrastructure and so on.
Are there governments around the world that could conceivably fall because of this crisis?
Traditionally, Asian governments depend very much on the rice price. And if the rice price increases significantly close to an election, the sitting governments usually don't make it. So, and right now, rice prices are extremely high. And therefore, the Asian governments, say the government of the Philippines and a number of other Asian governments, are concerned about their legitimacy. The rice price is really important.
Is there a solution that could get us back to the era of cheaper food, or are those days gone forever?
No, those days are not gone forever. Yes, we will get back to lower food prices, but it's going to take a while. We have to make the investments that would make it possible for farmers to respond to the current higher food prices. I believe we're going to have more food produced this year than we ever had before in countries such as Brazil, Thailand, Ukraine, and Australia. So I think over the next 5 to 6 years, we're going to see decreasing food prices.
Per Pinstrup Andersen is professor of food, nutrition, and public policy at Cornell University. Professor, thanks for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
It was technology's turn in the earnings barrel today. After the bell, Amazon reported a 28% rise in first quarter profits. Apple said its bottom line jumped more than 35%. That's got to have shareholders thankful for all those iPod and Mac owners out there. Thankful, too, for the advertising and marketing teams. They've made a splash with those commercials, the ones where the techno-hip Mac guy triumphs over the clueless PC guy. You've seen them, right? But Andrea Gardner reports Mac owners might be a little clueless themselves.
You know the commercial.
Hello, I'm a Mac, and I'm a PC.
Apple rolled out these ads to make you think Macs are much cooler than PCs. After all, the Mac guy wears designer jeans and sneakers, and the PC guy is overweight and balding. But over time, many consumers have found themselves charmed by the bumbling PC and irritated by the lofty Mac. Marissa Gluck is a marketing analyst with Radar Research.
The character of the Mac guy is almost too perfectly cast. He is smug. He is condescending. He's just that uber hipster you love to hate. It just makes you want to slap him.
According to a new marketing study, if you own a Mac, you might want to slap yourself. Mindset Media surveyed 7,500 computer users in 20 different personality traits, such as self-esteem, pragmatism, and modesty. They found that Mac owners pretty much personify the Mac guy from the commercials. Among other things, they think they're more extraordinary than the average Joe. That's according to Mindset co-founder Sarah Welch.
This is a group that is not afraid to shout its accomplishments from the mountaintops. They're happy and proud to talk about their successes and their accomplishments, and that can come across as possibly a bit conceited.
The survey revealed that Mac users often describe themselves as perfectionists. They're also more likely than PC users to whiten their teeth, drive hybrids, drink Starbucks coffee, and eat organic food. Nitty-gritty research like this helps companies craft an advertising message around their customers' mindset. Again, marketing analyst Marissa Gluck.
It gives advertisers just a fuller understanding of who their target market is. What are their preferences? What makes them tick? Why do they buy certain products?
Apple didn't commission the mindset survey, but it's clear that the company knows its buyer. Apple's computer market share has grown significantly since these ads debuted in 2006. But there are risks when companies create ads that precisely reflect the persona of their core consumers. For some, it could be too close for comfort, says Gluck.
I do think that Mac users recognize themselves in the Mac eye, but there's probably that uncomfortable recognition, that slightly uncomfortable degree of self-hatred that you've become a cliche.
After taking an honest look in the mirror, I too realized that the Mac cliche is fitting. Perfectionist, Starbucks drinker, organic eater, and yes, even a bit superior. Not surprisingly, I own a Mac. Ugh. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, making room for women in Saudi businesses.
It's a separate place, but it is it's in the same building. And if we need, we can just use the telephones to talk to the males in the other departments.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials warmed up 42 points today, a third of 1%, to end at 12,763. The NASDAQ rose 28 points, that's 1.1%, finished at 2405. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, nearly 0.3%, to close at 1379. MBAC Financial plunged 42% on worries about its financial outlook. The bond insurer posted a wider-than-expected first-quarter loss. Competitor MBIA shed more than 33%. Those billions in losses we mentioned over at Delta and Northwest clipped their wings to the tune of 3.5% and 5%, respectively. On the other wing, so to speak, higher deliveries of commercial planes helped carry Boeing aloft 4.5% higher. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Clarkson Potters, the splendid tables, how to eat supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for March. More talk about the housing biz. The National Association of Home Builders holds its Construction Forecast Conference. And the CEOs of Delta and Northwest join the House Judiciary Antitrust Task Force for a hearing on the recent merger. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It feels like it's been a while, I know, but not too long ago, the economy and the stock market were humming right along. Back then, a lot of people thought it might be a good idea to let Social Security take advantage of that. The theory was we could all do a lot better in retirement if the money was in the market. Commentator Robert Reich says we got lucky.
The best thing to have happened during the Bush administration is something that did not happen. We did not privatize Social Security. Had we done so, boomers facing retirement over the next few years would be even worse off than they are today. Now, they're struggling with pension plans worth less than they counted on and home values that are tanking. At least they can rely on a monthly Social Security check. But had we privatized, they'd be totally reliant on the stock market. And look what's happened to the market. Compared to stock values 10 years ago, the S&P 500 has risen a little over 1% a year, adjusted for inflation. Treasury bonds have done better. Go back 9 years, and there's been no gain at all. Yes, I know, it's been a rough time. First the tech bubble bursting, and then 9/11, and then Enron, and then the housing bubble bursting, and then the credit crunch. But that's my point. We can't necessarily rely on the stock market. And anyone who thinks the market will shortly regain all the ground it's lost over the last few years has been drinking Wall Street Kool-Aid. The Fed can only do so much. The stimulus package is a laugh. Consumers paying much more for fuel and food and health insurance, with shrinking paychecks, large debts, and declining home values, won't be turning around this economy anytime soon. Now, sure, the stock market has done well over the past half century, but there have been decades like the 1970s, and this one so far, where it's been a disaster. That's why we have Social Security, so that if your timing is bad and you get caught in a downdraft, you still have something to fall back on in retirement. If we had privatized, you'd have nothing to fall back on. You'd crash.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Farther down on his resume, he was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. Let us know what you think. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Jordan's King Abdullah had a quick meeting with President Bush today. It was a setup for the president's trip to the Middle East next month. He'll be in Israel and in Saudi Arabia. Less than 10% of the Saudi workforce is female, yet women make up more than half of that country's college graduates. Jobs that could go to women are held instead by men from countries like India and Pakistan. The Saudi government is trying to get its own citizens to work. It started hiring more women and encouraging the private sector to do the same. But Kelly McEvers reports now from Riyadh, change isn't coming easily.
About a year ago, a Saudi woman who works at the Ministry of Planning and Development had a meeting with her male counterparts.
There was two men, and there were like three of us, the ladies. We have met for, I think it was only like for 20 minutes.
Sounds like a regular day at the office. But in Saudi Arabia, it's a really big deal. That's because religious leaders forbid the mixing of unrelated men and women. Partitions, window coverings, different hours for men and women, all this is designed to keep the sexes apart. Now, the Saudi government wants women to start filling jobs occupied by foreigners, who make up at least a quarter of the country's 24 million people. Officials say the move is still in line with religious law, because, like at this woman's government office, men and women have separate entrances.
It's a separate place, but it's in the same building. And if we need, we can just use the telephones to talk to the males in the other departments.
Phone calls with men are fine, but meetings...
It's very rare. I think it only happens twice.
This is the conundrum of Saudi Arabia. Women want to work, but both sexes are still reluctant to put themselves in situations where they might mix. So the government keeps trying. The Ministry of Labor recently passed a law requiring shops and stores that cater to women to actually hire women. But, says journalist Maha Akil, store owners found excuses not to comply.
The businessmen objected that it was an added expense, you know, segregating the stores. You know, who's going to manage those stores? We don't have qualified women. You know, they have to be trained. By the time they train them, what are they going to do with the stores?
So, in the end,
the ministry backed off and said, well, we'll just make it optional.
And so far, no stores have hired women. Instead, they're staffed by foreign men. Architect and interior designer Nadia Bakhourji is seen as a pioneer for women's rights in Saudi Arabia. She ran for local office in 2005, even though women aren't allowed on the ballot. Yet even she doesn't hire Saudi women. She says the few who are qualified in her field are still afraid of working with men.
You know, some girls just don't have the confidence to go out into the workforce.
Bakhourji says most Saudi women have never even met a man who is not their relative. So the mixing of the sexes almost always means some kind of sexual tension.
I mean, my advice to any professional woman is if the guy tries to get difficult, either he's being sexually discriminating by putting your work down because you're a woman, or if they try to get fresh, if you know what I mean, you need to, you know, not accept any nonsense.
That advice might not go very far with 23-year-old Haifa Fahad Al-Ajra. She says she has no interest in working with men because if she was sexually harassed, she says through an interpreter, she'd have no legal recourse.
She said, you will find a clear and strong punishment for that in the United States. Unlike here in Saudi Arabia, there's no clear punishment here. So we need to do this in a gradual, harmonic way.
Al-Ajra says the segregation of men and women here is a product of both religion and culture. Imagine being told your whole life you need to be protected from the prying eyes of men, she says. You'd be hesitant to work with them, too. In Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, I'm Kelly McEvers for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note on the way out today, the Department of Justice wants to have a chat with Yahoo and Google. A couple of weeks ago, the two companies announced a little project they had in the works. They decided to try an experiment, 2 weeks worth of running their search engines together. Google's obviously number one in the market. Yahoo's number two. Regulators are said to be curious about the antitrust implications of that. Also, about a phone call that Google CEO Eric Schmidt made to Yahoo's Jerry Yang. Nothing wrong with a call, of course. Unless, as is reported, Schmidt offered his help in putting the kibosh on Microsoft's bid for Yahoo. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow rose 42 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ added 28 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, nearly 0.3% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, paying to be a pack rat.
You're going to say I'm going to be in there for 6 months or something like that, and I'm going to see you 5 years later, and you're still handing me money. And you paid more than 3 times what that stuff's worth, in some cases 4 or 5 times.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.